from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
My dad said we needed to talk, so we went in the living room, and they told me they were getting divorced.
It's a sentence no child wants to hear, a conversation no parent wants to have. Yet the divorce conversation is commonplace. It's just that one voice in that conversation isn't always heard, the voice of children. We'll talk about children and divorce and hear what kids have to say as captured in a new film called Split. It's ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
Me and my brothers went downstairs, and we peeked in the kitchen, and we saw my mom and my dad fighting, and we didn't want them to see us, but it made us really sad, and they just broke up.
That was Julia, one of the voices captured in Ellen Bruno's new film, Split, which simply and unrelentingly captures how children see, hear, and experience divorce. They're the only voices in the film, the only testimony that's given. 1.5 million kids experience divorce each year in the United States. In that sense, it's commonplace. But the experience, of course, is anything but. In this hour of Forum, we focus on how children experience divorce and what parents can do in response. Joining us, Ellen Bruno. She's an award-winning documentary film producer and director. She produced Split, which is a film about kids and divorce. Also recently produced a film called Sacrifice, which is about child prostitution in Burma. Ellen Bruno, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Jeff Cookston. He's professor of psychology at San Francisco State University. Jeff Cookston, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Marge Slabaugh joins us as well. She's now a private judge, formerly a San Francisco court commissioner dealing in this area of family law. Marge Slabaugh, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
So I wanted to start with that story that we heard in the introduction, Ellen Bruno, about what kids hear and that first moment when they know that this has gone that something has gone awry in their life. Tell us more about the kinds of stories you heard about what kids really dial into in that first moment.
Well, the story of what happened or the moment of realizing what's happening is quite profound, that moment for a child. And it's one that children never forget. And oftentimes when I talk to adults who went through divorce as a child, they're eager and almost compulsively need to share the story of what happened at that moment. It's such a profound turning point in a child's life. most often, it's a very difficult one. Even if the divorce is ultimately for the better, it means a child's world is about to change in a very profound way, and there's a lot of fear of the unknown. The child doesn't know really what's coming next.
Is there a way of having that conversation, Jeffrey Cookston, that is more helpful to a child? Or is there just no getting around the fact that this is going to be unraveling for who that child is and what they are now going to face?
Well, a lot of it depends, I think, on the age of the child. And so you want to meet the child at their developmental level. So if a child is younger, then you might explain that there's going to be parents living in separate homes. If the child is older, then they may have seen this coming and anticipated this. And so giving them information, asking them questions, asking them if there's anything that they would like to share about that experience can be very helpful ideas.
Does it matter from the get-go, Marge Slabaugh, in your experience, that from that very first moment, how you talk, what you say counts?
It absolutely matters. And the real problem is that while the parents are going through their own pain and anger, their parenting ability is impaired. And they're not able to see the children in their child's pain as well as they should, as well as they would at any other time in their lives. So it's very difficult to meet them where they need to be met, to comfort them the way they need to be comforted. And that's why it's so important, I think, for parents to understand their own impairment and arrange for mental health professionals to assist both them and their kids at that time.
In a way, it's a moment when you have to be at your best when you're not at your best.
And you're probably at one of your worst, yes.
How do you begin to contend with that impairment, as Marge Slabaugh so candidly puts it, Jeff Cookston? What do you do to overcome that impairment and somehow dig deep to give back what you need to give?
Well, Commissioner Slabaugh made a great point that oftentimes in the time of divorce, there's a lot of erosion of the quality of the parenting that the child has grown accustomed to. Parents tend to be less warm. Their discipline tends to be more inconsistent. They might be more rejecting. And also their own mental health symptoms may be exacerbated. So in some ways, this conversation is the beginning of a new era, is the beginning of healing. Children frequently prior to divorce are exposed to a great deal of interparental conflict, as the clip from the documentary showed. And so we want to reduce that, because when children are exposed to frequent and intense conflict, it's very distressing to them, and they don't get used to it. People sometimes think kids get used to it. They don't.
What's so telling about the film, your film, Ellen Bruno, and we'll play another clip here in just a moment, is they don't miss anything. I mean, they hear and see and take in what's going on.
Exactly. They're very wise, and they're very intuitive, and they're very tuned in energetically to their parents. And so they know when something is happening. And if they don't get enough information, they'll fill in the blanks. And kids have very wild imaginations. And I know as a child, that was the case with me when my parents separated. I didn't have enough information. I knew something was going on. And so I constructed a story that was actually quite a frightening one and very different than reality. And so, you know, I think part of the challenge is knowing just how much information to give a child.
And one of the things kids often think about, and we'll play this excerpt now from your film, is that they sometimes think it's their fault.
Exactly.
And that's sort of the first place they go. So let's listen to some kids talk about that.
Sometimes I feel like it's my fault my mom moved out, because they were really fighting before, and I thought maybe that I was sort of hard on my mom because sometimes I'd go on my dad's side of the problem, but it wasn't that, I don't think.
Sometimes I think that because I'm mad or mean or did something bad to them, I think it's my fault that they're divorced.
And there's just like a lot of problems that I had no idea about. And I was making up questions and answers in my head, thinking like really bad things. I told my mom, like, I really want to talk about this. And so then she sat down and she told me everything that was going on. And even though it wasn't that great, I still wanted to know what was happening.
Commissioner Slabaugh, when you hear those voices, both the kids who said the first place they went to is that it must be them, must be their fault, and that last child who said, I wanted to know what's happening, what do you hear when you hear those kids?
Well, actually, the problem for most judges in a family court is that they don't really hear from the kids. Mm. And legislative processes over the last couple of years have made it clear that the child's voice needs to be heard by the judge. How that gets heard is another question. Should it be from the child directly to the judge? Should it be through a mental health professional? Should it be through a parent? Clearly, it needs to be a more direct approach, I think, at this point. But judges need to be trained about how to hear it. One of the things that Ellen said earlier reminds me that kids already know what's happening. So when you ask about what should parent say to the child, I think one of the first things that a parent should do is ask what they think they know. Hmm. Ask them what their questions are, and then give them answers to their questions rather than to give them what the adult thinks the answers are. So what do I hear when I hear a child's voice like that? I hear the pain. And what I try to do is help the parents understand how to get assistance, how to get outside help for their kids.
And what is your advice on that, Jeff Cookston, about when a child says, it must be me? You know, if they've fallen out of love, it must be because it's something that I did.
Mm-hmm. And children get a lot of cues that that may be the case. It's difficult to prepare meals and clean the house, and sometimes parents will communicate that. So it's important rather to bring the focus back to the parents and to make sure that the child understands that the conflict was occurring between the partners, that there was an incompatibility in the fit between the partners, and that both parents love the child and are always going to be there for the child. Children are really at risk when conflict in the home goes unresolved, when it's there and they don't know if it's ever going to end. And so to give the child a sense that parents aren't fighting, that things are okay for now, and that the relationship with the child is the most important thing, to helps the child feel secure emotionally.
When you were doing this filming, Ellen Bruno, what were there moments that just jumped out to you when your ears opened wide and you thought, oh my goodness, that's something I need to be thinking about. Were there things that surprised you that you heard from kids that changed your own view of what this experience is like for children?
The thing that surprised me was how universal their feelings were. And it seems, all the books say it, and I had trouble believing it, but after interviewing 22 kids, I realized that many, if not most kids, do in some way feel this is their fault. You know, that they are central to everything that happens in the family, and why should this be any different? And also that most children really wish and hope, you know, long beyond it's possible that their parents will get back together. And so those universal feelings, it surprised me just how commonplace they were.
Well, let's listen to more on that very question, since you've brought us to that, this longing that so many children experience.
Can we just rewind and live in the same house and the same old world?
Sometimes I feel like I could go back in time and fix it. Like some of my dreams were that.
Well, that's not gonna happen, but you can still wish it. That's what they usually say.
Sometimes I just really, really ask, and I purposely cry to make them go back together, but it doesn't work. It really doesn't work. You feel sort of powerless, but it's like, it's just not your ball of wax. It's theirs.
I found that last comment, Ellen Bruno, so perceptive. It's not your ball of wax. It's theirs.
Right. I think that's the secret key to getting over the sort of pain for the kids, is realizing that this is not in your control. Change happens for the good and the bad. You need to just be a kid. This is your parents' ball of wax, so to speak. And putting down that heavy burden is a huge relief.
Jeff Cookston?
Yeah, it's complicated because so many parents in divorce will reconcile for a time. Some will reconcile for good. Some will reconcile for a brief time. And those cues can be very troubling for children because they think that might be the case long term as well.
How do you go about counseling parents on that score? Is it proceed with caution, Mart Slabaugh? Be careful what you are suggesting may be possible when parents are kind of debating whether they will split or whether they won't. What do you suggest that they do when there's some ambivalence about this?
Frankly, I haven't seen much of that in my courtroom. By the time they get to me, and they are arguing their positions in the court, they've sort of gone beyond that possibility of, they've gone beyond the ambiguity. So I'm not sure that I can answer that. But if that were the case, I'd probably tell them to keep their ambiguity away from the children. Don't give them the cues that they have false hope.
We're joined now on the phone as well by Claire Barnes, who is with the organization Kids Turn. She is the outgoing executive director of Kids Turn, an organization here in San Francisco, which is a nonprofit that helps kids and parents navigate the divorce process. Claire Barnes, thanks for being with us as well.
Well, I appreciate it. It's nice to be part of such a familiar group of people.
What is your thought on that about how when kids feel a sense of powerlessness, but also this longing for something that's possible, how do you work with kids to come to terms with that?
You know, one of the things I was struck by in the recording, and I've been listening while I've been on hold, was how articulate the children were, and I assume that was a clip from Ellen's film.
It was.
Split. And some of the children that we work with in the Kids Turn program, some of them are so young that they don't have the language to express how deeply this family chaos affects them. And so we have encouraged, for 25 years, we've encouraged art expression and some of the expressions that we see through art of parents arguing and the children in the middle. One of the most compelling ones we have, I call the Green Family. It's a child who's below two arguing parents looking up and just feeling so helpless. So a lot of times the kids don't have the capacity to express how it touches them and how it feels for them. So it's really important that the parents stay in tune to what's going on with their children during this time. One of the most strongest recommendations that I could give or we would give to parents would be to stay engaged with their parenting, because their children need them now more than ever.
Claire Barnes joining us from Kids Turn, where she is the outgoing executive director of that organization. Claire, stay with us as our conversation continues. We want to open up our phone lines and welcome you to our conversation as well. If you are dealing with this issue in your own life, we'd like to hear from you. If you've gone through it and have some thoughts about how to get through it, we'd like to hear from you as well. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website as well. Here's some things that are already have been posted on Facebook. Faye says, my parents separated when I was 10. Their divorce finalized when I was 17. I told them when they broke the news, I screamed at them that they were ruining my life. But what I now remember is learning a lot about who my parents are as people, how they dealt with the stress, and that every person has a right to get themselves out of an unhealthy living situation. Shauna writes, I was 16 when my parents separated. They officially divorced about 5 years later. My parents are both better partnered now in their late 60s, and the adult in me can see that that marriage wasn't meant to them. But despite that, part of the child in me will always wish that they were still together, because it would have made things easier for me. What do we know, Jeff Cookston, about the long-term effect? It sounds that for Shauna, this is something that has stayed with her. Do we know much about the lasting impact of divorce on kids?
Very much. It's been studied extensively, and children who experience parental divorce are at increased risk for a number of psychological and socioeconomic impacts. And luckily, however, we also know that the reason that this happens is because of things in families that can be changed: exposure to conflict, changes in parenting, exposure to parental mental health, and maintaining contact with the non-custodial parent or the parent who has less time. So this, we do know that divorce has a negative impact, but we also have the tools and the knowledge to know how to protect children.
Well, so central to that seems to be this question of conflict and what kids glean from that. So let's listen to one more cut from Ellen Bruno's film where kids talk about what it is like to experience that.
Once, I think it was my mom, after a fight, my mom got really mad at my dad and she threw the phone on the ground and called him a bad word, and I got really mad at her, and sometimes my dad does that too.
They are just fighting and fighting, and you are just so sad.
I never, like, really cry showing it, but I, like, feel really, really bad inside. I don't say it because they're like in the middle of a fight and they really like probably won't listen.
Marsh Leibaugh, conflict. What do you try to suggest to parents about its impact?
That is the worst possible thing that can happen to the child during this divorce process is to see, to experience, to hear the verbal and physical conflict that goes on between the two parties. And most parents will tell me, yes, but the kids weren't there when that happened. They know. They were there. They were upstairs. They were peeking through the kitchen door, as we heard earlier. They could hear what was going on in the next bedroom. They know. They experience it. And it is the most devastating thing that can happen to a child because it's such an unsafe, unsecure, uncomfortable, unstable feeling for a child that who longs to have that security and that comfort. So what I tell them is, stay away from each other. And of course, if somebody asks for a restraining order as a result of domestic violence or something of that sort, I frequently suggested that they stay away from each other for at least a few months to sort of get past the worst part of it. And that doesn't mean that the children stay away from either one of the parents. It means that the parents stay away from one another. Let the children experience each of the parent without that conflict. And so it's the only thing that I could say to them. I can't stop the conflict except to keep them away from one another.
And Claire Barnes at Kids Turn, how do you teach that to parents? I mean, it seems so fundamental, but how do you break through the question of blame and finger pointing to say, you got to set that aside? Claire Barnes?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay, one of the things we emphasize with parents is that how important their role is to teach children how to resolve and to model for their children how to resolve conflict without all this fighting. It's a tremendous responsibility that parents have during this very critical time to remember that they are setting the stage and teaching their children how to solve problems. So if they can learn ways to manage their emotions and to navigate and modulate those emotions when emotions can be out of control, this can be a very frightening and scary time for children. But that's what we do is we teach parents to recognize the feelings, learn ways to modulate them, and remind them that they are teaching their children how to solve problems.
Claire Barnes at Kids Turn. We're going to take a short break. We have lots of calls lined up. When we return, we will get to Mary and Barbara and Tina and all the rest who are joining in and get to your comments and concerns about how to contend with this difficult situation. Comment coming in now on Facebook. Gina writes, my parents divorced when I was 13 in the 1980s. The change in the family dynamic was difficult. I was the sensitive one, but I was actually relieved when the argument stopped. My father couldn't get over his anger towards my mother afterwards, and when I had visitation with him, all he did was talk badly. I hated my time there. Some of the many difficult situations that kids have to contend with, and when we return, we'll talk more about how kids fare in this situation and what parents can do to help that process be easier for kids during these difficult times. We welcome your participation in our program. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. When we return, we will hear from all of our callers. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, kids and divorce. What can be done to make that experience less horrific than it often can be? We're joined by Ellen Bruno, who has made a film about this called Split. It's a film about kids and divorce. And if you'd like to see it or learn how you can obtain the film, just go to splitfilm.org, splitfilm.org. Ellen joins us along with Jeff Crookston, professor of psychology at San Francisco State University, and Marge Slabaugh, a retired San Francisco Superior Court commissioner, now a private judge. We welcome your calls as well at 866-733-6786, and let's get right to them. Barbara joins us first in Alameda. Barbara, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I heard the topic, and boy, it brought up a whole lot of emotions for me, and I was remembering my son, who's now 28. His dad and I split up when he was just two, and he had to move back east, and I did everything I could to sort of keep them in touch with each other, and we had a pretty amicable divorce. And as he got older, I didn't really think about, you know, his relationship with his dad was his relationship with his dad. And then he was a senior in high school, and he got into a little trouble, did a little senior prank, and we were called into the office, the principal, and his dad and I were talking to him, and he broke down and started crying. He said, "I'm sorry. He goes, I'm such a bad kid. That's why you guys got divorced. I know I was a bad kid." And I just looked at his dad. We both got, like, tears in our eyes. I'm like, "Honey, how could you think that? We never." And he's like, his whole life he'd been carrying around this feeling that it was something that he did as a little two-year-old that would make his dad and I, you know, not want to be together. And I've always tried to make it clear to him, you know, even moving forward, like, you know, he's 28 now, you know, make a living amends to him, to just constantly remind him, you know, that he's just this great guy. And, you know, his dad and I, we just didn't love each other. You know, we thought we loved each other, and we loved the idea of having him as our son, but we just didn't love each other. And it was just so heartbreaking to know that even if you think you're doing everything right and you're not arguing and, you know, you're just moving on with your life, that they are still harboring these internal feelings that, like was said before, that they cannot express. So they just carry it and carry it and carry it. So,
yeah. Barbara, thank you. Thanks for telling that story. It's a powerful example, Claire Barnes at Kids Turn, of how these stay inside you, don't they?
Yeah, they absolutely do. And, you know, one of the important elements that we've brought as part of the family dynamics and are encouraging are even encouraging children to connect with their grandparents. Many of their grandparents have been through this as well, and they are kind of the family historians, if you will, and they can assure the grandchildren, number one, it's not their fault. Number two, this is a life difficulty that they will be able to get through, that the grandparents will be there for them and be a very understanding and supporting resource to the grandchildren.
Marge Slabaugh, it's a really important point, isn't it, that as intense as this moment is, it will pass, and there are other sources of continuity and resilience that kids can draw upon.
Absolutely. It may be a school teacher, it may be a neighborhood friend, it may be an aunt, a grandparent, and it's especially helpful if it's a family member, because the child then gets the message that this is an important family community, family dynamic. Even though my parents aren't living together anymore, we're still all family. And resiliency is such an important issue to talk about, because children are resilient. Hmm. Given the right tools, given the right parenting, once the parents get past their anger and pain, the kids are resilient.
What are some of those tools, Jeffrey, Marge Slabaugh, Ellen, that promote resiliency?
Well, an eminent developmental psychologist refers to the ordinary miracle of resilience and how children want to cope, and they're trying to make sense. And conversation is an important function. They need to talk to their parents. They need to talk to their grandparents. There's equivocal research on whether talking to other children is ideal, because often other children won't call the child on issues, but will instead just be unconditionally supportive. But talking to others, seeking distraction, there are activities families can do where they basically get away from the divorce, and they share time without talking about the divorce, and that's important.
The children in your film, Ellen Bruneau, all seem to have that quality of a resilience, almost sometimes to a point of thinking, gosh, you're maybe a little older than you should be.
You know, a lot of people say that about these kids. How did you find such articulate kids? And in fact, kids are very wise, especially around their own experience. And this is quite a deep experience. And I think they were very relieved and eager to be able to share their experience. And we really saw this as a collaboration. You know, we approached this saying, you know, you're going to be talking to other kids that are just starting on the path, and your experience will be very valuable to them. And they'll take comfort in knowing that you've moved through the difficult parts and you've survived.
That you're not alone.
Exactly.
Barbara, thanks so much for your call. Let's go next to Mary in Pleasanton. Mary, go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm in Pleasanton. I'm 67 years old, and I'm actually somewhat surprised at how recent my parents' divorce of 55 years ago was. I was the fourth of six children. The first one that my dad was home when I was born because of World War II. I had a very, very close relationship with my dad. In fifth grade, that was the only time I ever heard my parents really screaming and yelling and everything. And the next morning, my mom said that my dad was leaving and told me, Mary, you need to ask your dad to stay because you're the only one who can make him stay. It wasn't until I was in college that I realized I carried the guilt of it was, I didn't make him stay. I failed my mother. I failed my father. I failed everybody. And intellectually, I understand it, but emotionally, I'm surprised how it still resonates in my whole being. And probably the one scar I carry is I have a pretty strong fear or anxiety around abandonment. Hmm. So parents need to be real careful what they say.
Yeah.
She didn't mean anything bad. She was just grasping what she could grasp.
Thank you, Mary. And Marsh Labott speaks to what you said initially about that parents sometimes are just not at their best, and they'll say something perhaps not with any ill intent, but it winds up being just not appropriate. And do you find that often, that parents just wind up in a way kind of using kids in a way that, in a sense, Mary's mom did, that's just not right? Just not appropriate.
Absolutely, it happens a lot, and yes, it's not because the parent is a quote bad parent. Right. It's because the parent is not able to be at their best at the moment. But those words, that action, will stay with that child forever, and that's the hard part. It's a scar we get from, you know, bumping down the sidewalk or whatever, but. So it stays with you. But one of the things I would suggest that parents try to do is keep your child out of the middle. Don't make your child the messenger. If the child is going back and forth between your two homes, don't ask the child to tell daddy he hasn't paid his child support yet. Things of that sort. The child is not your agent, nor is he or she your doppelganger, your other self. That child's relationship with the other parent is very different and separate from your relationship with that other parent.
And you also recommend sometimes that parents should email each other, that even though we'd like to think that conversation is always a good thing, if you're really not able to have a conversation, you're much better off putting it in print, and you also remind them of who might see that email.
That's exactly right. I frequently saw the email when I was on the bench. They would be attached to the parents' declarations, and they were horrifying. But I'm so glad that they were in email rather than speaking to one another in front of the children. So yes, I would suggest if you have that kind of conflict, you deal with it in letters, email, texting, and so on, and keep it away from the children. It's also a really good trick to copy your email to somebody, a third party, who you know will be watching your P's and Q's for you since you can't do it yourself at the moment. Hmm. It reminds you that you don't want to do or say anything in your email that somebody else would find horrifying.
Sometimes when I'm emailing something that might be difficult, I email it to myself first.
Yes.
and read it and then set it aside, read it again and
right.
set it aside. That sometimes you need that sort of double-checking process.
If it's a really important, lengthy, big decision, I would suggest that that's something that a parent does. But if it's one of those, I've got to respond immediately, You can't sleep on it. You can't email it to yourself. You've got to communicate it right away. Then the best thing to do is to make sure that you're also copying somebody else. It keeps you reasonable.
Tina is next in Sacramento. Tina, go ahead, please.
Wow, this is such a great conversation. Thank you so much for having it. It's been 19 years since my son's father and I split up. And when we made the decision, the first thing we did was go and speak to my son's counselor and his kindergarten teachers for advice about how to bring the decision to him in a way that would help him cope the best. And that turned out to be waiting a whole month until he'd gotten himself in school and gotten his feet on the ground, and then waiting another month before my ex actually moved out of the house. But we made a commitment back then to do our best not to badmouth each other and not to put my son in the middle. And throughout, he was 4 and a half when we split, and throughout his growing up years, I consciously created opportunities for he and his dad to do dad-son things together. They built fences at my house. They drywalled the garage. I mean, they did all sorts of things together. My son is now 24, and he sent an email in the last year to his father and me in which he acknowledged that he had always wanted a, quote, normal family, but in the end, he wouldn't have had it any other way, that he got the best that both his parents had to offer without the influence of the other, and if he was having a fuss with one, he always had the other one to go to.
Tina, thank you. Thanks for telling that story, and congratulations, I think, for handling things the way you did.
It's a lot of work.
I want to turn to a subject we haven't discussed a lot yet, but one that is sort of fraught in many ways that you get to in your film, Ellen Bruno, and it's the back and forth thing that happens with kids who are either going through divorce or whose parents are already divorced. It's if it's Tuesday, I must be with Dad sort of stuff. Let's listen to kids talk about what it's like to be going back and forth.
I live with my mom on Mondays and Thursday nights and Friday nights and Sundays.
I have my mom Sunday, Monday, Tuesday.
But then on Wednesday nights I'm with my dad. And on Thursday nights I'm with my dad.
Two nights with my mom, two nights with my dad. Two nights with my mom, two nights with my dad.
I go back and forth for my birthdays. This time for my birthday I'm going to my dad's house. And then next year I'm going to go to my mom's. But sometimes I wish I could have my birthday at my mom's, but I can, but I want it to be fair.
Another excerpt from Ellen Bruno's film, Split. Claire Barnes, so striking, that sort of back and forth and back and forth. But what was also striking to me is the last child who says, I want it to be fair. Kids seem to have a real sense about that, too.
Yeah, they do. And it's interesting if parents stand in the shoes of their child for a moment when they're making these decisions to try to see what it feels like to have your whole world turned upside down and all this upheaval and practically everything in their lives goes completely out of their control. So these setting up these schedules so that they are predictable and depending on the age and stage of the child. For example, beginning in elementary school, they have calendars and they can start to track so that it becomes predictable and steady without a lot of interruptions when mom or dad are supposed to be there to pick up the child. They need to be there to pick up the child based on the schedule. So it feels like there is some steady predictability that kind of comes out of this chaos.
It's so much the norm now, Jeffrey Cookston, about shared custody and the back and forth thing that we heard in that excerpt from Ellen's film. What do we know about that? Has much been studied or learned about the to and froing?
Well, I think an important thing is that the child have contact with both parents, if those parents are of a state where they can accommodate that. So we want them to have time with both parents. So shared visitation is important. However, the child should be able to have some voice in that at some point, that if the schedule is a hardship for school activities, then there should be opportunities to revise and change that.
Ellen Bruno?
I think, we made this film for kids and families and to discourage conflict when parents are separating. But we also made this for all of the kids whose parents aren't divorced, so they have a better understanding of what their friends' lives are. It takes a lot to manage two households and move back and forth, and a lot of kids don't really understand what their friends are going through, and they need to understand what the back and forth means, and that they left their, textbook at one parent's house, or they can't attend a birthday party because they're with the other parent. And so there's a lot that all kids need to learn through the experiences of the kids in Split.
Marcela, how do you deal with that question of balancing the to and the fro, and the question of fairness, which seems to be something that kids care about too?
Well, certainly something the parents keep bringing up, but yes, the kids are very, very cognizant of that word and what that might mean. You know, Dave, one of the things that I recall from my lengthy years of practicing in the family law area is that there was once upon a time when the children, it was felt that the best thing for children was to be in just one house and maybe visit the other parent off and on. What we learned about the kids at that point was that they were yearning for the absent parent, no matter how bad the absent parent was. In fact, there was great yearning. There was great feeling of being abandoned by that parent, and that child had fewer benefits as a result of non-contact with that parent. And so we traded that great yearning and those fewer benefits now for this, what often seems to be a complex back and forth scheduling of the children, and who knows what the long term effect of that is, except that, as Jeffrey pointed out, it really is important for children to continue to have frequent and continuing contact with both parents, and such that it is significant contact. It's not just a visit with Santa Claus Daddy or whatever we might call them today, but it's a relationship development. It's really having a parenting relationship with the child. So when the decision maker, if the parents can't work out a plan on their own, when the decision maker has to figure out a plan, they have to take into account the child's developmental stages, the parents' location in relation to one another, whether they're living in the same county or state or country, and really try to keep the child in a stable situation but with great contact for both.
Back to our calls. Let's go next to Chris in San Francisco. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm in the middle of the throes of this right now. And I'm basically based in San Francisco right now, and my daughter and her mom are back in New York. Her mom is really doing a lot to try to withhold her and withhold our contact, and it's just been really just beating the crap out of me.
Hmm. Claire Barnes.
Boy, that's a tough one, isn't it? Where one parent has, for whatever reason, or the geographic limitations or restrictions have created this scenario. So I feel for this dad. I'm sure the daddy sounds like a very bright and intelligent guy, and is exploring all the opportunities that Skype and all the electronic communications now that we have available. This is happening around the country, that families and parents are using all these technological tools and buying, if appropriate, buying cell phones for kids so that they have the other parent or their parents on and can have easy access to them. But I sure feel for this dad, and he's got a challenging situation, there's no doubt.
Jeffrey Cookston?
Yeah, well, there's often we refer to this in the field as a parental alienation, and this does not usually work out well for the parent who's engaging in the alienation. if a parent is capable and competent and one parent is withholding time, children sense that, and the long-term impact is less favorable for that parent. There's usually a psychology associated with the divorce pertaining to who is seeking the divorce and then who is responding to the divorce, where the person who is seeking it maybe was thinking about divorce a long time before it came up, was imagining a life after divorce. And so the transition post-divorce can sometimes be easier for this individual than the person who is responding to the divorce, who may know that the relationship is at risk, but not anticipate that this is happening. And so that's a way to influence the nature of the relationship. Conflict within families is oftentimes about maintaining that relationship. If I'm fighting with you, at least you're paying attention to me.
Mm-hmm. Chris, good luck. No, it's a difficult situation to go through. And I do think that resources like Kids Turn, Claire Barnes, who's on our program with us, may have some additional guidance that they might be able to provide. So perhaps that's also a source of information that you can pursue later on. Best of luck, and thank you for joining us on our program. Thanks. Let's go next to Beth in San Francisco. Beth, go ahead, please.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm probably back a topic, but I'm from a divorced family where we spent the bulk of our time with my mother during the year in school and then spent summer time with my dad. And I'm a mother now. We're still married and have grammar school age kids, and I have many friends who have divorced. And this back and forth with the schedules during the week of this 50-50 split kind of custody seems to be just such a nightmare. And the parents who I know see more of each other and have more conflict because of so much contact. And I just, after the divorce, it seems like they're in touch more, having worse situations. The kids are distressed. They're never in a stable day, and they do know their schedules. But it just seems so disruptive, yeah. And I wonder why the rationale has become so much towards that 50-50 split, if that's a family decision usually or if it's a court decision.
Okay, let's get some
curious about why that
happened. Yeah, let's get some response to that. Come to Marsh Labor in a moment, but how, what was your sense of the kids you talked to, Ellen Bruno, about how they were managing the, if it's Tuesday, I'm here, if it's Thursday, I'm there?
Surprisingly well. And, you know, there were certain kids that were literally rotating every day from household to household, and it was mind-boggling for me imagining doing that as an adult. But kids are resilient, you know. They fall into the patterns and they remember and they look forward. And it's important for them to really know what the schedule is so that they can plan ahead. And
is that the key, Marsh Labaugh, to be clear about and consistent?
Clear and consistent, and making sure that if what our most recent caller describes as a lot of conflict and a lot of contact, if that's in existence, then the transitions need to be without contact by the parents. In other words, the transitions have to occur, say, at school or at childcare or someplace like that, so that the parents aren't handing the children off and have that opportunity to start yelling and screaming at each other.
That moment of exchange is really fraught, isn't it?
It really is. And one of the scenarios that you and I talked about 7 years ago, I believe, was the scenario of the child who was walking between the two parents' cars in a parking lot at 10 o'clock at night as a transition because they weren't able to have actual contact with each other. It hasn't changed. If these kinds of schedules will work so long as there's not conflict around it, and that's the key.
Brian writes in, my parents divorced when I was 4, and it's never felt wrong for me. I would appreciate it if your speakers would speak to the perception of divorce as intrinsically wrong or devastating, as was said a few times over the program. I've had friends whose parents stayed together for the kids and have always felt that the idea of divorce as toxic was wrong. Claire Barnes, it's an interesting point that Brian makes. Can you comment?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, interestingly enough, this is a social element that occurs in our culture. 50% of all children experience this.
by the time they reach the age of 18. And so it's as normal as an intact family. And the fact that there isn't more conversation about it being more normal than not normal, is something that's always frustrated me in my role at Kids Turn. So one of the things that we do with families when they come into the program is say, you know, you're here, you're experiencing something that occurs very frequently within our culture, and try to alleviate the guilt and shame, if you will, that may be associated with it.
Julie writes in, my parents divorced when I was 20, and my brother and I wish that they had divorced a decade earlier so that we could only live with one. I don't think it's divorce that's traumatic to children. I think it's living in a bad marriage that can be traumatic. Just have a moment left, so let's get a few last thoughts from each of you. Mark Slabaugh, first, in this difficult, most difficult of all circumstance, is there a single principle, I guess, that parents should keep in front of them?
The principle is that this will be over someday and that things will be better on the other side. I have met some parents many, many years after they were in front of me in the courtroom who have confided that things are fine, that they are good, that the parents are talking with one another, that the children are growing up well and happy. So even though it feels devastating at the moment, and you don't think you're ever going to get beyond this, there are better days.
And Jeffrey Cookson, a number of listeners have written in to ask, is it better to divorce or stay together for the kids? An impossible question in so many ways to answer. But how do you sort this out? How do you keep kids first?
Well, there is evidence that it can be harder on children if it's not a high conflict family and they weren't aware that this was in the works. But then the high conflict families are valuable ones that should dissolve in many cases. If I can offer one suggestion, there are a number of behavioral strategies that you can use to reduce conflict in a relationship. Square your shoulders to a person. Look them in the eye. Acknowledge and nod to let them know that you're hearing what they're saying, even when it's so hard. It's very hard to fight with a person who's looking at you in the eyes when that's culturally appropriate and fits within a relationship.
And Ellen Bruno, last thought. Again, if you would like to get a hold of Ellen's film, you just go to splitfilm.org. What did you learn?
I learned that the human spirit's incredibly resilient and that children are wiser than we give them credit for most of the time.
Good note to leave things on. I want to thank Ellen Bruno for making the film and for being with us, along with Jeffrey Cookston, Claire Barnes, and Marge Slabaugh. Thanks all very much for being part of our program. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.